Right, we'll get going. There's a couple of people arriving a little bit, isn't that right? But we'll get started. Cheers for coming down. I'll just say a few things about Steve Higginson, who's speaking today. We met Steve a few years ago through some odd connections. The bookshop's obviously called The Hydra, and if you look on this bookmark, it says something like... The Hydra, a many-headed beast born of a typhoon, a hurricane, whatever, and Echidna, half-woman, half-snake, was a powerful image of revolt during the rise of capitalism in the 17th and 18th centuries. So the reason the bookshop has a connection to why we know Steve, really, the bookshop's named after the Hydra because the Hydra was a symbol of all the revolts that appeared in the 17th and 18th centuries as Hercules, the symbol of the merchant classes, kind of colonised the new world and exploited millions, if not tens of millions of people in the process. But all through that time, there were revolts by sailors and indentured labourers, slaves, obviously Caribbean slave revolts, and all across that Atlantic world there were revolts. And the Hydra represents that, because every time the merchant classes and their armies and their East India companies and all the sort of mechanisms for exploiting that new world, not just in South America, North America and across the Caribbean, every time they tried to put down a revolt, another one sprang up somewhere else. So that's where the symbol of the Hydra comes from. And you may have not seen this book, if you need to write, called The Many-Headed Hydra, which is where we learned about this. So I definitely recommend that text, because it had a massive influence on starting up Bristol Radical History Group. That book was written by Peter Linebaugh and Marcus Redeker, two American historians who we spoke to very early on when Bristol Radical History Group was forming. Basically, we spoke to Marcus Redeker, who's an expert on piracy and maritime, what they call the maritime hierarchy, the kind of revolts that went on amongst sailors and other maritime workers in that period. And we wrote to him in 2005 when we were first thinking about doing some events around the radical history of the Atlantic in Bristol, and he said he was very supportive. He said, yeah, do it, you know, this is a good idea, you know, Bristol's perfectly placed because it's a port city, as is Liverpool, another port city that's certainly involved in the transatlantic slave trade. So he was very, very positive about it. But one of the things he said was, he said, you need to speak to this group in Liverpool that we came across a few years ago, involved in the Writing on the Wall collective, and they put us in touch with us and said, talk to our people we know in Liverpool, because they're on the same track. They're looking at this kind of outside the nation understanding of history. So kind of going against the idea of, say, British history, but looking instead at the history of, say, the Atlantic proletariat. There's huge numbers of people moving across the Atlantic, whether as West African slaves, or whether as indentured labourers, or whether as sailors or soldiers, you know, developing the new world. And all of those people were involved in revolts against that system. So we talked to Writing on the Wall, and that was the way we got in touch with Steve, who was one of the people who was involved in some of that work. I think that was probably in 2006. That's how we got to know Steve. Since then, Steve's come down and done several talks, particularly on time, work, labour, discipline, its relationship to port cities and how they're different, how there's different kinds of, say, political and social behaviours in those cities. I mean, some people are, I mean, I would say that, I don't know what you think about this, but one of the most spine or hair-raising moments in my life was watching the FA Cup final after the Hillsborough tragedy, which you might remember back in 1989. And in that cup final, I remember, you know, usually seeing Abide With Me, and then the national anthem, then Abide With Me. And the national anthem began on that FA Cup final in 1989. The Liverpool fans drowned it out. In fact, everybody there drowned it out by singing I'll Never Walk Alone. And I always interpreted that as something about Liverpool, which is the fact that Liverpool, as Steve has argued, is not really part of Britain. So he's certainly within that framework of looking outside the idea of national histories, and in fact looking at what actually happens, the movements of people and the movements of culture across the Atlantic. So that's what Steve talked about in the past. But tonight, I mean, I just to put you in context of what's been going on this year, about a year or so ago we talked a lot about 2011 being the anniversary of 100 years since the strikes in Liverpool in 1911. Some of the groups across the country involved in radical history have been involved in a bit of Churchill bashing. We certainly have, because we'd like to take the iconic image of Churchill apart and really expose perhaps what the real history of Winston Churchill is. He obviously has a connection to 1911 in Liverpool, which Steve, I imagine, will mention. So we've been involved over the last couple of years, and in Liverpool they've been running a series of events, which Steve will outline, about the history of 1911, which is an iconic Liverpool history. So I know there's been an awful lot of controversy about this new history, and Steve's going to kind of outline some of the work he's been doing on 1911 and some of the new perspectives which have created consternation in different quarters and in the history groups of Liverpool. So I'm just going to hand over now.
All right, thanks a lot, Rog. First off, on behalf of the people who've been running these series of events back in Liverpool, we are absolutely delighted to come down here and speak at the opening of the Hydra bookshop. We really are, you know, it's probably the highlight of what we've been taking around Liverpool, having this gig down in Bristol. 1911, iconic year in Liverpool. For 4 months, the city was under martial law. Gunboats were moored on the Mersey because of a strike of dock workers, seafarers, and railwaymen. Now, Winston Churchill, a month into the dispute, in reply to a question in the House of Commons, made this statement: "You need not attach any great importance to the rioting in Liverpool last night. It took place in an area where disorder is a chronic feature." And I must admit, I don't often, well, I never agree with Winston Churchill, but he got it right on that that quote. Now, what's taken place over the last 12 months in Liverpool is very, very conventional in terms of the history of Liverpool 1911. We started doing some research back in January, because really the conventional history of 1911 is very, there's too many loose ends, too many yawning gaps, and there's some huge paradoxes which have never ever been resolved. Now, conventional Labour history and radical history would say that what took place in Liverpool in 1911 was a syndicalist revolt. That's what they put it down to. But it's quite bizarre. If you're going to call it a syndicalist revolt, then when you have a look at the demands of dockers, seafarers and railwaymen, their central demand, according to their trade unions, was for the government to mediate between labour and capital, what they call conciliation and arbitration boards. Now, I would argue that that is about as far removed from syndicalism as you can get. Because syndicalism, to me, my reading of revolutionary syndicalism, at its core, was always to smash the state, not bring the state as a mediator into industrial life. The other aspect of, well, it's quite a huge contradiction, is the fact that, again, conventional radical history in Liverpool and elsewhere has seen it, what took place in 1911, as being down to a couple of trade union leaders. The leadership of Tom Mann, the leadership of the dockers' leader, James Sexton. Now, the problem we had with that was because when we started looking at government papers of 1911, the government were very, very concerned, because they said the disputes have gotten out of control the men will not listen to their leaders, and a young group of new and unknown leaders have sprung up. So what we started looking at to try and look at these contradictions is really what was really going on in 1911. So what we did when we started writing about it, we came to realise that 1911 is the year that Joe Hill writes the great Labour movement anthem, "You'll Get Pie in the Sky When You Die." 1911 was when the Mexican Revolution broke out with Zapata. 1911 was when the first art of Pablo Picasso arrived in Liverpool. 1911 was also where Liverpool became the base of a group of radical educationalists who were all anarchists. And what we decided to do in looking at 1911, we came to the conclusion that you can't separate what was taking place industrially from what was happening culturally, artistically, musically, and a whole other plethora of art forms, because the way we've always argued our politics is basically the working class are always far more than just the job roles. There's always far more attached to working class people than just work. So what we started looking at first off is the transatlantic influences of 1911. And if you can think that in 1910, over 120,000 Liverpool seafarers shipped out to America, New York, on a transatlantic run. 120,000. That many, in fact, that the seafarers' union leader, a fella called Havelock Wilson, to try and prepare for a seafarer's strike, had to spend 6 months in America trying to marshal his own union membership. Didn't spend 6 months in this country, 6 months in America, because that was where the bulk of his membership were. Then what we came across was the fact that all these Liverpool seafarers had docked, jumped ship in America. And at that time, the union organiser for the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, who was working the Brooklyn docks and the New York docks, was a wonderful woman of colour called Lucille Parsons. She was working alongside James Connolly, famous Irish agitator. And we started to argue that if you've got 120,000 seafarers who jump ship in New York, then it beggars belief that you would argue that they wouldn't have come under some kind of influence of Lucille Parsons, James Connolly, and the industrial workers of the world, the IWW. Because again, we tend to forget that in 1905, when the IWW was founded, one of the signatories to the IWW was James Connolly. And Connolly ends up, in 1911, working on the Belfast docks. The same time the Liverpool dispute had broken out, Belfast and Dublin break out as well. So what we started to try and do is to make all these connections. That rather than see it, 1911, as being a dispute linked to this group of English trade union leaders, there was far more transatlantic influences, if you like, at play. What kicks off the dispute? Well, this is where And I think it's the same with any revisionist history. This has caused quite a furore back on Merseyside, the reasons that we've said the dispute broke out. The various meetings, I'm shouted down, being called a heretic, a dissenter, a sower of seeds of dissent, which I'm made up about, really. That's who I am, and that's what I've done always. Anyway, so makes no difference. I'm delighted with those labels. The dispute doesn't break out in Liverpool. It actually starts in Southampton. And the reason why it starts, and the radical Bristol Radical History Group have heard me speak on umpteen occasions about this question of time and industrial time. It starts off at Southampton Docks. And we must remember that, you know, 100 years ago, the majority of workers on the docks were casual. What takes place in Southampton is five workers are told to attend for work at 6 o'clock in the morning. They attend for work and they're told there's a log jam in the dock, therefore you'll have to hang round and we'll call you back when you're required. They were called back at 11 o'clock. However, this day, what they said was, well, look, you've kept us waiting from 6 till 11. We weren't paying for that. That in itself was quite a revolutionary demand. These five individuals said, we weren't paying for that time, 6 till 11. And they were out on strike for 5 hours. In the end, the employer conceded and the ships started to leave Southampton. But in the meantime, what they had secured in Southampton had spread to Liverpool. Because basically, it's the same in any industrial dispute. If one group of workers gets something, another group will say, well, we want some of that as well. So the same demands that took place in Southampton were then being applied in Liverpool. And there were two particular reasons for that. Is that transatlantic liners were getting quicker and quicker and quicker. In fact, 1911 saw the Mauritania, the transatlantic run, Liverpool to New York and back, it broke the world speed record. But on those ships, the workforce are being expected to work quicker and quicker. When the ship docks, the dockers are expected to work quicker and quicker because they've got to turn it round and get it back out on the outgoing tide. Now, we would argue, and we do argue, that what we were seeing, what we see in 1911, is the birth of speed-up capitalism, which we're living, you know, we would argue, and we might have a debate about this later on, the epitome of that is the age that we live in today, where everything's instantaneous. We don't have any time or space. Everything's compressed into the instant. So, all what Frederick Winslow Taylor had written about in 1911, he was the father figure of time and motion, whereby every little movement of a worker was being timed and broken down on a production line, basically to turn groups of workers into robots. And that's what was happening on the ship and on the docks. And that is the core element, really, of the revolt that took place. And what's very, very interesting is that, again, some of the people we've upset back in Liverpool. The two people I worked with on this project, we've got a combined level of trade union. We've all been trade union shop stewards and trade union officials. What we did, we went to all the agreements that 1911 secured, and it was quite clear that what 1911 was about was time, because every one of the agreements covering seafarers, dockers and railwaymen are to do with this element of work time. So if you're a casual worker and you're told to turn up at 6 a.m. and there's no work for you, you will be paid from 6 a.m, irrespective of whether there's any work for you. If you're told to turn in on a Saturday and Sunday, you won't be classed, those days will not be classed as normal working days. You will be paid overtime, double time, and in some cases, treble time. So we've got this whole construct of time which is enveloping Liverpool at the... It's quite embarrassing when you read some of the comments from the trade union leaders at the time, because their particular argument with the employers, and this is where we've always got to differentiate between what trade union leaders are saying and what the rank and file are saying, because there was a massive gap in 1911 in terms of what the leaders were saying and what the rank and file were saying. And that's why it took so long to get the workforces back to work. That's why it ran on and on and on for nearly 4 months across that long, hot summer. The other element, which I touched on before, that we can't separate from what was going on in the docks. I've seen there's a book here by a Brazilian educationist, Paulo Freire, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And that is basically, Freire developed this concept of anyone who works in education today, it's either called active learning, student-centered learning, or experiential learning. Yeah, it wasn't Freire who came up with that concept. A group of anarchists in Liverpool in 1911, a wife and a partner, Nellie and James Dick, also another anarchist called Leonard Abbott, they had set up in Liverpool from 1908 what was called a modern school movement. The modern school movement was based on the teachings of a Barcelonian anarchist, Francisco Ferrer, who was assassinated by the authorities in Barcelona in that same year. So Liverpool from 1908 onwards had this thriving, independent, anarchistic form of education. And what's very important to note, James and Nellie Dick and Leonard Abbott sailed to New York in 1912, and there they set up the biggest modern school movement the world has ever seen. So big that the great, American philosopher and educationist John Dewey, it was at that school where he got all his influences from. But even though they sailed to New York in 1912, their influences are still felt in Liverpool today. And quite simply, those influences are that Liverpool has a history of from the 1960s onwards, when local authorities have tried to shut schools down, the north, the south, the east and the west of Liverpool, We've seen this development where communities rise up and refuse the authorities the opportunity to close them. The last one was a comprehensive school in Croxteth, which is an outlying district in Liverpool, that is now called Croxteth Community. It's a university within the community. Wonderful, wonderful place of learning, cultural, artistical, and it's still going strong today. And that was because the community said, no, you're not closing that. That is the focal point of our community. So there's a history there of people refusing to accept what education authorities say and the local government, keeping control of their own schools and education, which you can trace back to this great anarchist tradition in Liverpool from 1908 onwards. Another interesting point about 1911. Any of you been to Liverpool at all? Have you ever been down to the waterfront? Liverpool's waterfront is, after New York, it's the most well-known waterfront in the world because it's dominated by three major buildings called the Three Graces. And what's interesting is that the architecture who designed those buildings and his students, he was in charge of Liverpool School of Architecture from 1904 onwards, a fellow called Charles O'Reilly. And it's just interesting to note that when we start talking about all these cross transatlantic influences in politics and culture, there was also these wonderful influences of architecture as well, because Riley was going backwards and forwards to New York to have a look at how New York's waterfront fitted in with the city itself. And then he came back to Liverpool with a wonderful comment that says, river cities should always reflect the river. So they should be built, you know, alongside of and apart from the river, to reflect that aesthetic of why river cities are different. So he was very, very important. I mentioned Picasso, but alongside Picasso, there was the first showing in Great Britain of what we now know as the post-impressionist movement, the revolution in art. Cezanne, Gauguin, Matisse, Van Gogh, that was shown at the Blue Coat Chambers in Liverpool in 1911. And again, when you have a look at those forms of revolutionary art, you can see what those particular artists were rejecting. And we would say that they, just like dockers and seafarers, were rejecting Taylorism and work study and this obsession with converting the human body into a piece of clockwork, that Matisse, Gauguin, Cezanne, Picasso were also rejecting in their particular areas of art, that very same mechanical, robotic way of painting and drawing.
Can I just ask a question? You know, when you're talking about this time in between 1908 and 1911 or 12 in Liverpool, and the people who were involved in it, I would just be interested to know what your research has thrown up about how much the Afro-Caribbean, the Chinese and the Irish diasporas that were in Liverpool then, how much of those communities were also involved? Or was it predominantly the English working class who were... I know that, you know, I'd just be quite interested to know, did they perceive themselves as people do now in Liverpool? They perceive themselves as Liverpudlians rather than English people. You know, they first of all think of themselves as Liverpudlians. Did that happen then? It's just I've got a history. My dad was a Liverpudlian, and you know, my family were from Liverpool. So I just sort of just interested to know about that time, whether people thought of themselves as Liverpudlians or.
No, you're quite right, really, because the dock strike that occurred was kicked off in the north end of Liverpool docks. What Eric Hobsbawm, in a very derisory comment, wrote off of, just call them Irish Catholics.
Yeah.
So he never gave any credence to that union. The south end of the docks were the rigidly English Protestant skilled dock workers, carters, and there was still major tensions between the two.
Yeah.
But it was the north end of the docks that drove everything. Liverpool Irish.
Well, that's what I thought, that's what I've been told.
That's where Jim Larkin comes in, yeah. And James Connolly, yeah, comes in, even though they're over in Dublin and, yeah, Belfast, their influence is still being, yeah, felt on the Liverpool waterfront. The in terms of Liverpool's African community, we haven't included anything of those in the industrial setting. What we have done is come across this wonderful story of a young Liverpool lad called Gordon Stratton. He later became known, or sorry, his original name, born in the north end of Liverpool, Irish and African descent. And from 1904, he's a clog dancer with Charlie Chaplin in Liverpool. So what we've called the new industrial movement, the new educational movement, the new architectural movement, the new artistic movement, is now joined by another new movement, which is the birth of ragtime. Now, people have said to us, well, how do you equate this young Billy Masters with ragtime? Well, it's quite easy, really. 1911 was when the first ragtime record, Alexander's Ragtime Band, becomes a number one hit in New York. Billy Masters sails out of Liverpool at that time. Chaplin follows him a year later. And by 1920, Billy Masters had introduced jazz into France and Europe. He then took jazz to Buenos Aires, another port city in Latin America, where he fused the jazz form with Latin American rhythms and forms of dance. So what we've done in our work is we've brought to the service this new history of this individual, who's basically been written out of Liverpool history. But again, we would argue you cannot separate that musical movement from all the other movements that are taking place. In terms of how we look at, because the piece that our work is actually called Rhythms That Carry. And what we've tried to do is apply what took place in 1911 to what's taking place today. And when you think about it, in terms of this group of workers for the first time ever, securing all these new payments for waiting time, working time, overtime, travelling time, all these plethora of payments that these workers had secured for the first time ever, and then compare it to today. Last year, the TUC TUC report that British workers are now contributing £29 billion worth of free labour to British employers by working unpaid overtime. And what's part of that, of course, is this other generalised form of work, which I get very concerned about, volunteerism. You know, Liverpool City Centre now has a whole range of artistic, cinematic areas where young kids are working for nothing, just to be able to say, well, I've worked for that company and I've got that on my CV. Liverpool City Centre today, 2 miles away from the dockside area, is probably the biggest site of female exploitation that we've ever seen in the city. We've got the biggest retail, what's it called, Rich? Liverpool One?
Abomination.
This retail shopping mall, predominantly staffed by female labour, minimum wage, minimal rights, mass exploitation. So I'm in the middle of doing this other project at the moment because of a lot of these young kids, their working week is over 7 days. So they get the same pay for Saturday and Sunday that they get for Monday to Friday. Very similar to what dock workers and seafarers were getting over 100 years ago. How we make an inroad with those young people who work in these areas, what I found very, very interesting is that when you speak to them about their working week, and when you speak to them that would they like to be paid overtime or double time on a Saturday and Sunday, they grab it at one, you know, they get it in one. And it's just a pity that particular trade unions who organise retail sectors of the economy aren't using that argument enough. Because I think there's a massive potential there for new forms of representation and new forms of trade unionism as well. The other issue, which I mentioned before, is this question of Taylorism, time and motion. What we normally do when we've done this event in Liverpool, we normally show, anyone seen Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times? Where he's on the production line, and he's getting quicker and quicker and quicker. And then he slips off to the toilet for a slight smoke. And then all of a sudden, his boss appears, who's got it on camera and shouts him to go back to work. And the genius of Chaplin with that film is he's predicted everything that happens today in terms of surveillance, the pace of work, the labour process that's gone from being collective to individual, with the levels of internal surveillance as well. Finally, what we also came across was, I speak every year at the James Larkin Memorial Festival in Liverpool, and Jim Larkin leaves Liverpool in 1913, goes to New York. 1919, he's prosecuted for criminal anarchy. And he's prosecuted by a very young district attorney by the name of J. Edgar Hoover, who later becomes the head of FBI. So we go James Larkin, JL, 60 years later, John Lennon, JL, both being persecuted by this particular individual. Larkin gets jailed for 10 years, ends up in Sing Sing. He's released after three, never ever the same, by the way, when he is released. But of course, what we wanted to do is trace back to see what Larkin was doing to what he'd been up to in America, because J. Edgar Hoover called James Larkin the Archangel of Anarchy. And it's fascinating to trace Larkin's steps in New York. And I'm delighted that being in the Hydra bookshop, we came across James Larkin was a co-founder with Lucille Parsons and a group of other assorted anarchistic syndicalists. Larkin, they founded this club in the south side of Chicago called the Dill Pickle. The Dill Pickle was the name of a very popular ragtime tune at the time. And this is the only book that's ever been written about the Dill Pickle. The Rise and Fall of the Dill Pickle, Jazz Age in Chicago's Wildest, Most Outrageously Creative Hobohemian Night Spot. Wonderful book. This is a space that's created in Chicago, and this is the best description of it. In its day, the Pickle, as most of its habituees called it, was regularly packed to full capacity. A rare outpost of free speech, intellectual funhouse, joyful rendezvous of hobos, poets, artists, revolutionaries, and various unclassified oddballs. Its poetic and carnivalesque reputation has not only survived, but prospered over the years. That's a great depiction of the Dill Pickle, and I would suggest that is also a great depiction of what the Hydra bookshop promises in the future. So thanks a lot for listening to me.
Questions then? Cake will be here in a bit. That's my question. I got a question if anyone's got a question. Can you explain why? Because what was one of the most exciting things about the work you've been doing is the connection between IWW, Industrial Workers of the World in the States, and Liverpool. And there was, like, I've been spreading rumours that, you know, one of my sort of revolutionary heroines, which was Lucy Parsons, had connections with Liverpool. Can you sort of outline where those connections came from, why they appeared, and who was involved in it?
First appeared in 1905 when James Connolly, Liverpool Irish, found a member of the IWW. Connolly then is a labour organiser on Brooklyn Docks alongside Lucille Parsons. We can't find any track of Lucille Parsons coming to Liverpool. But what we can find track of is this continuing transatlantic influence of the Wobblies. So Big Bill Haywood, who's the figurehead of the Wobblies from 1910 to 1913, is a constant figure in Liverpool. We've got this wonderful photograph of him with alongside James Larkin, and again, a forgotten history. 1912, the secretary of Liverpool Trades Council, the councils of all the trade unions, was a lady called Ma Bamber. And we've got this wonderful photo of her, Larkin, and Haywood before Haywood's due to speak at one of these massive big labour meetings in the north end of Liverpool. And that continued. So that there were actual branches of the IWW set up in Liverpool. In fact, there was probably more influence of the IWW than there was of conventional Marxism and socialism. And I think that chimes in with the different nature of Liverpool trade unionism. And when I say that, I'm not saying it in an arrogant way, I'm just saying that it's a fact of life. That all my trade union life, I don't think I ever was involved in one dispute about wages. Never about wages. It was always about my own respective workforce reacting to authority and discipline. And I think that is traced back to the spontaneous nature of how the Wobblies organised back in those days.
How do you think Liverpool in the present day reflects what you were saying in the past, and how is Liverpool as a city responding to, you know, what its government's doing in terms of cuts and things? Is there organising? Is there historical remnants of organising still there, or is there major organising? Is there parallels, you know, with what's going on now and then?
The Merseyside area has got the highest density of trade unionism than any other part of the country. The Merseyside area has got more trade union leaders and more trade union officials than any other part of the country. And of course, out of the 7 or 8 big unions within the TUC, 6 of those leaders are from Liverpool. However, and this is the problem, and this is where I run into major differences with my old comrades on the left, is that, okay, we can accept that, but you go to the north end, the south end, the east and the west, there are these massive industrial estates that were built just after the Second World War. The industrial estate and the housing estate. Some of them are 6 or 7 miles on the periphery edge of Liverpool. One of them that we're doing a project around now, at its peak, Kirby Industrial Estate provided work for 89% of the housing estate. That figure now is barely 9%. These areas are literally in a land that time has forgotten. Young people, 2-3 generations unemployed. Mention Trident to them, you think it's a new computer game. It's a fact. There is no neighbourhood or family connection with trade unionism and radicalism. That has been wiped out. How we reconnect with them, I don't know. I haven't quite got to that. Because their lifestyles are very individualistic, their collective nature of life is minimal, and these are the things that I would argue were always very, very important to radical politics and radical trade unionism over the centuries, that you had families, neighbourhoods and community. That's where your roots were. And these things got passed on. I don't see that happening anymore. That's what worries me, really.
So, what is the experience then of Liverpool as a changing city in response to that then? Would you say that, how's that impacting then on a city which has had such a strong history of, you know, that you were just talking about, would you say that that's now in decline?
Well, I don't think it's reacting very well to it, because I was speaking to Mark and Roger about it. Again, part of this project that I'm involved in is looking at this whole question of what's called a post-industrial city. That's, you know, Liverpool, and somebody said it's the same with Bristol to a degree, because the industry, skilled and semi-skilled, is gone. The city decides where we've got to go for leisure and tourism to bring people into the city and get them spending money. What we're seeing in Liverpool at the weekend now, over a 48-hour cycle, it's something I've never ever seen before, where the city literally becomes colonised by hen nights and stag parties from all over the country. Over a 48-hour cycle. What goes along with that, which is something that we've never seen in Liverpool, is a rise of lap dancing, strip clubs. And what's linked to that is this appalling violence, male on female, that goes on every weekend. I would argue that's what you get when you sell your soul to tourism, consumerism. That's what it generates. So, no, it's not. It's not living up to its past heritage very well, I'm afraid. And that's because no one's coming up with any answers, you see.
Steve, what about the large population of transient population of students as well?
The large population
transient
students. Well, I've been out with the leaflet thing for UCU the last month, and I find it hard to equate with what I see when I'm out leafleting trade union-wise with people who seem to think that students are going to be storming the Winter Palace next. Don't see it at all.
I was thinking more along the lines of, I remember a few, probably about 5 years ago, there was the councillors from Everton were requesting that no more students' residences be built in Everton, because the population had just become too seasonal, and that in the summer, because there were no students there, the population of Everton plummeted. And I was thinking more of effects of the traditions of Liverpool as having a unique identity has changed, because a lot of the population is there for 3 years and then bugger off, and they're not rooted in the city as much.
But what, like I must admit, what they have brought with them, and what you're tending to see now, is that they are regenerating parts of the city that were dying with the birth of Liverpool One and the big shopping precinct. The outside, some of the outlying streets, which were some of Liverpool's oldest shopping, where when Roger and some of the group came up to News from Nowhere, that's one of the oldest streets, Bow Street. They're undergoing some kind of rejuvenation now through the student population and others who feel totally excluded by the conventional consumerism. And so, no, I would welcome students, Rich. Sorry about that.
I just want to make a quick comment. I mean, I think there's a bit of an illusion about when you're talking about the fragmentation of working class community and culture and stuff as a result of what's happened perhaps over the last 30 years. I think it's important to realise this is often talked, it's kind of romanticised a lot of the, I mean, obviously there's a material basis to those connections in, working class community or whatever in for many hundreds of years, but I mean, reading anything about British history teaches you one thing, which is that the working class has never had a stable community. Like, it's all, if you look at, if you read The Making of the English Working Class, which I'll definitely recommend, if you read that book, or other books who talk about it, the history of the working class in Britain is constant disruption and movement and dynamics, because, people talk about the collapse of, say, Welsh mining communities after the end of the miners' strike. Well, those communities were created by disruption.
Yeah.
Working class, we react or even are ahead of the game sometimes in terms of what's going on in those communities. We create those things. But But the point is, there's always been disruption. So it's not, I know, I mean, it's a pretty bleak picture, and I think it is a bleak picture, but it was a bleak picture in 1825. It was a bleak picture in 1850. It was a bleak picture in 1932 when there was, you know, unemployed marches down this very street getting attacked by the police. And there's always been this need, you know, the idea of working class community being stable for like hundreds of years is really quite an illusion, I think.
No, well, I don't. You see, what I would argue to counter that, Rog, is that Marxism and every other type of ism would say revolutionary consciousness, all that type of thing, is caused by masses of workers all being under the one roof and forging this collective consciousness. Where are all these masses of workers all under the one roof?
Well, that's because we haven't got a manufacturing industry.
We don't have a manufacturing industry, but what do we have in its place?
Shopping.
Very, very individualised forms of working. So my nephew's just walked out of Sony. He was there for 7 years, put him on the verge of a nervous breakdown, because he's working at a computer terminal all day. He's not allowed to speak to people on either side of him. And during his break in the dinner times of socialising, that's frowned upon, because they give them individual games and all this type of thing. Now, I find that type of thing very, very scary, you see. Because again, that's just another element of this individualization and, what can you call it, alienation from the social, you know, from sociability and social life in general. And I don't think we've quite got a handle on how to deal with that at the moment. I really don't.
I also think that I come from the Forest of Dean, and I grew up in Sindbury, which is like a small mining town. Now, when my dad, he said there was like 45 pubs in Sindbury, a population of 10,000 people, right? Like, I just went back this weekend, and one of the, like, there's probably about six now, and one of them was just shut down, so it's probably five. There was a miners' welfare hall, which is on its last legs. There was huge amounts of community resource where people interacted. And all that, I mean, I'm not saying pubs are obviously the best place, but that whole community, sense of community, and community interaction is being eroded by, you know, look, if you took pubs as an example, you know, you have bars, you don't have areas where people go and sit down particularly. You don't have communities based around these community centres, or, you know, all this stuff is gone. I mean, I remember in the early 90s, I used to work in an unemployed community resource centre in Sindford, and we used to have things with one in Kirby.
That's right.
And they were like sort of one model of re-engaging with communities. But there's nothing. Like, I'll go back to Sindford. There's no leisure. There's nothing. It's fucked. I mean, it's a dormitory town. There's no young people. Or there's no employer, and there's no community space anymore. All that community space is gone. And if you can even look at Bristol, you see it all the time. Places which were once maybe religious even, or, you know, community spaces, and they've just been commodified and they're gone. So where do people meet? You know, they don't. And I think that's a sign of this individualism as well. You know, where, you know, people sit at home drinking. It's too expensive to go to the pub, or it's like their pubs aren't there anymore. Whereas, you know, this lack of solidarity is very difficult, I think, to achieve now, because there is nowhere, you know, really, where people just interact on a normal day-to-day basis and sit around going, oh, actually, we're shit, you know, or have you thought about that? That's gone. That doesn't happen.
Has that not just migrated to the internet? Because there's a whole for the younger generation, but there's a whole network of communities.
It doesn't compare.
I know it's not the same, people still need to feel a sense of community and connecting. It's just they're using different means now.
Online communities is the people choose who they interact with. It's not like a normal community where you have a mix of different ages and different people.
Yeah.
You, it's
So identity communities.
Even
really.
So, yeah. It's still lovely when you meet with people that you normally communicate with online in a physical space.
Yeah, yeah.
And sit down and have a few beers with them.
But where
the difference between sex and porn, really?
where's the mythological community where everybody interacted? I don't think it ever really existed. And you know, if you look at lots of communities, and I can remember going to a village actually where Desmond Tutu was actually a chaplain for a time in Surrey, and it became very clear to me that this tiny little village was stratified into a middle class which was focused around the Church of England, and a working class which was focused around the Methodist Church and so on, and never the twain meet. And the same in the same terms of things. So I think we have to think that the real problem is that the people who are workless are desperately effectively queuing for a living, and cannot even afford to go out and down the pub. Even if you go in and there's times when I'm feeling a bit tight and just go and have a half. You know, that's still £1.50. That's £1.50 you haven't got if you're living on benefits.
I totally agree about this definition of community. I mean, this idea of like community, like, you know, there's a community in this area, there's a community, it's all ridiculous. I mean, a lot of critiques of this have gone on, but I mean, the point is and there is massive divisions. I mean, this sort of came up in the riots in August, you know, we're all the community, we're attacking our own community. No, what do you mean my community? Like these, you know, a load of business people around here, are they my community or are they not? Like, you know, so this idea that there's this unified community is ridiculous. As you said, there's class divisions throughout the whole of this. You know, there's people who own businesses, people who got no work, there's people who don't own anything, there's people who own, you know, massive houses who live somewhere else. But the point is, you can't just dismiss that immediately and say, well, you know, we're totally individualised. There will always be a human need for sex rather than porn, right? So, if you see what I mean. Okay, so there is a human need for that. I don't believe the internet will ever replace that human need, right? And there will be a battle. The question is how is that human need for social life ever going to realise itself in a time when that's being reduced into the internet? What's going to happen? And I would say you'll see all sorts of weird shit going on in the next 20 or 30 years. It'd be really interesting, I think. You're going to get stuff like the equivalent of stuff like football hooliganism, right? Which most people misunderstood, really, because that provided all sorts of feelings of community and excitement and action and the escape from boredom of work, for example. So you might see all sorts of stuff that's quite nasty, but it actually might be a reflection of that need for something real. You know, something real and something really involves some kind of drama and human reaction. So you have good stuff and bad stuff. And I really don't know what I'm going to see, but I don't believe you'll be able to crush that. That human need will not disappear for that. There will be a lot of frustration, a lot of depression, I think, and a lot of feelings of something not quite right. I'm lacking something as a human being, and I think that's what we'll see. Whether that can be turned into some kind of explosion, I don't know.
Yeah, Roger, if I can just stand up here for the internet and modern technology. I mean, you take the people down camping on College Green at the moment. Because of the virtues of modern technology, and thanks very much to the council's free Wi-Fi network they can get there, they can talk online to the people St Paul's all over the world. And perhaps that's one thing which I think is perhaps worrying the powers that be in the state, is that ordinary people are busy talking to one another all over the world, exchanging ideas, exchanging tactics and stuff like that.
Someone once told me that the Royal Mail was set up so the King had a monopoly on reading everybody's mail. I don't know if there's any truth in that, but the same sort of thing comes to mind, like using the council's Wi-Fi. It's a bit surreal. Yeah. Like it's kind of a bit different.
Well, I accept some of the points that people are making, but you see, when you read about what's going on in Silicon Valley, the way I view technology now, I've gone back to reading Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. because another element of my life that I deal with, Asperger's and ADHD, I had to go in to look at, you know, what goes on, people who suffer from it, what goes on in our brain. And when you realise that the brain, the soft element part of the brain, more and more neurobiologists are saying now that young people's involvement with technology means that that part of the brain is becoming rewired, technical. Then basically you're back to, what was it in Brave New World? Soma, was it?
Soma, yeah. Sorry.
Where you've got a chip in you. I find it quite scary, really, because what's going on in Silicon Valley, trying to produce artificial intelligence, and the people who are involved in all this are the very mega rich. You know, they're looking at building, you know, virtual islands that they can go and live on. So I just find it quite off-putting, really, what the future would bring in terms of technology. I don't see it as being liberating. I see it ultimately as being quite depressing.
Yeah, I'm not having a go at this. I'm drawing a distinction between. Yeah. Let's think about the telephone, right? When the IWW was kicking off, the telephone was appearing right now. You know, see, I'm sure that many stupid newspapers said that the telephone was causing industrial disputes or was causing, you know, riots or something. But the point about the telephone is the telephone's a useful tool to talk to someone who's a long way away, right? But you wouldn't want to continue all your human relationships through the telephone, would you? Well, would you? And I think I would have a severe human need not to use a telephone if I was having to use it all the time. Now, a lot of people sit all day using bloody telephones, don't they, in these call centres or whatever. So it's like, that is part of a diet. But if I had to live in a world where it was just a telephone, I mean, you know, you're going to be mad.
You're going insane.
You're going insane. So it's not going to go at the use of the telephone to communicate, to do something. It's about the fact that, you know, that it becomes to dominate all of your life. It dominates your work time and it dominates your leisure time. And I can't fucking handle that. I mean, maybe I'm getting old. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. When I get the bus in the morning, and it's just something that I observe constantly now. No one talks, no one reads a paper. First thing that the majority of people do when they get on the bus and sit down, they get the phone off or headphones on. Is that really what it means to be human? I don't believe it is. You see, I and of course they just spend the whole of the journey looking straight ahead or looking down. Get off the bus, go into an office, and doing exactly the same, looking on a screen.
They come home to the same thing for leisure as well.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's a good example, I think, the bus, because you can't be too negative. Like, I ride the bus a lot, that happens a lot, but the same thing, it seems like every journey something happens on the bus and everybody's involved in it, you know, like, and people do talk about it. There is, to gossip, you know, like, and all, like, sort of to find a sort of a reaction. So there's some kid at the front sort of mouthing off, and you'll see a few of the older people look, you know, and arch. Even that is human contact, so I don't think that you can be too negative. Whatever you want to do, innit? Yeah, whatever you want to do. It won't me to hit him, that's all I'll say. But no, carry on, mate. Yeah.
Two quick points. One is that we're talking about spaces, the need for spaces. One of the things that has happened is this, I think, is the fourth Radical Bookshop to open this year, and the fifth due open in a couple of weeks' time. And this has almost doubled the number of Radical Bookshop meeting spaces in the country. So perhaps that is a response to what's going on. The second thing I wanted to say is that the lemon drizzle cake is ready and someone needs to go and collect it.
Does that someone want a coffee for the road?
How about that, Dan?
One question, actually, because I don't actually know that much about the Liverpool strikes. Were they, how did they get defeated? Were they split or were they broken? Like, sort of, did they get one group of workers to go back first, or was it just they just starved everyone out?
No, the it was quite, just yet another massive contradiction. What the seafarers and dockers leaders wanted, this conciliation tripartite service, when the railwaymen came out, their demand was to scrap that. So there was this level of solidarity down below, but not, there's too many contradictions, you see. Seafarers and dock workers got what they, not what their leadership wanted, what the rank and file wanted. The railwaymen didn't get their arbitration board scrapped, but what they managed to do was, because a lot of these boards could sit in judgment and it would take years and years. They were like talking shops, never have achieved anything. What the railwaymen finally achieved was time limits. So any issue that was put to that board had to be replied within 14 days. So it wasn't a major victory, but it was something far better than what they had originally.
I was fascinated to hear Michael Portillo's little programme on Radio 4 about the police strike in 1919, where one of the main areas that actually came out was Liverpool. But one of the sort of things there was a suggestion that they had expected the rest of the trade union movement to come out with them, but of course because of the way in which the police had handled 1911, there was no solidarity with the police at all.
In fact, what the police strike caused, because there's some wonderful observations about what took place during that time, where in particular areas of the city, because there was no police around, the breweries were attacked and some of the food warehouses. And there's a wonderful scene where a very well-known novelist, Priestley, I think, describes seeing this scene, which was something like something from a Hieronius Bosch nightmare painting, you know, of barrels of beer pushed down the street, food overflowing from wagons, and then someone turns up with a piano and has to sing along, you know. But what the police strike, what I forgot to mention, what's very, very important about Liverpool in 1911, a month after everything had been resolved, the first ever school children strike, the whole across Liverpool, where school children, under no leadership, or just walked out on strike against authority, the wearing of uniform, corporal punishment, the way the lessons were conducted. First ever strike, prior and since, I think, of school children going out. Very interesting. Right, where's this drizzle cake?
Well, firstly, can I thank Steve Higginson for coming down to speak for us. Steve is just the first part of Scouse Sunday, just one part of the Radical History Week. At 7 o'clock today, we have Sheila Coleman, who's Steve's mate, coming down from the Hillsborough Justice Campaign to speak to us about what's been going on recently in the campaign with the Freedom of Information request, the government debates, the Hillsborough panel. And then later in the week, we've got nothing on Monday or Tuesday this week, but Wednesday is strike day, and we have John Desmond over from Wales, who's talking about the lessons from the Tredegar Medical Aid Society, which was the forerunner of the NHS, a community-run local health service. On Thursday, we have...
We've also got free coffee for strikers.
Free coffee for strikers on Wednesday. On Thursday, we have a film, Rebellion in Patagonia, which is being presented by Carlos Garita of the IWW. And it's a film based on... Oh, using my phone here to remind myself. Oh, no, that's not working. Okay, it's a film on... Argentine strikes. The film was made in 1974, and it's an award-winning film, a very controversial film. So, if you want to come along and see that on Thursday, on Friday night, Roger, who introduced the talk at the start, will be speaking on the August riots in Bristol and putting those in context. And we have some film as well on that. On Saturday at 2 o'clock, we have another event which isn't part of Bristol Radical History Group, but is part of or associated with the Palestine Film Festival, which is David Massey, who's an Israeli activist who works with a joint Israeli-Palestinian organisation, who will be down to talk about recent political struggles on the West Bank, and that's at 2 o'clock on Saturday. Check out the website if you want to see what other events are going on. We're hopefully having several events every week for the first few weeks, and please support us by buying books and coming to the events.